your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Many people look to be self-employed at something local, organic, sustainable, and not requiring a large investment. Well, one such enterprise is beekeeping. Selling honey to make a living, plus there actually is some surprising ways that a beekeeper can make money other than selling honey. But what's it really like to be a beekeeper? My guest runs Twin Bee Apiaries in Alameda, which has amazing Yelp reviews. Andre Krugliakoff, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you.
So, how'd you get into beekeeping, of all things?
We moved to Alameda about 12 years ago from the peninsula, and we planted some fruit trees, and they flowered and produced no fruit. So there were not enough bees in the area. So my wife for a while used to climb ladder with a pipe cleaner and pollinate them by hand, and she got tired of it, and at some point she suggested I do something about it. And what I did about it, I got a couple of hives of bees, and that's how it all started.
Huh. And you said that you quickly became fascinated with them. Tell me what the fascination was for you.
Well, there are a number of things about the way the hive functions, right? There's the way the bees communicate with each other, the way the bees can dance to tell other bees how to locate source of nectar. There's a way the bees that decide where to move a swarm. So What happens, the scouts go to different locations, and if they like it, they come back and they dance, describing all the advantages of the hive, of that potential location. And it goes to a point where they actually try to silence scouts that try to advertise other locations. And eventually enough scouts go to a location, and if they like it, the whole swarm moves there. So it's like a democracy in action.
Huh. So I guess the dance would be a bossa nova.
I guess.
That's terrible. It's just terrible. Walk me through the process of how honey is made from wherever you think we should start.
Well, I mean, it helps to have bees. So once you got the bees, you need to have some place to keep the bees. So if you're handy, you can make yourself a hive. Otherwise, you buy one. Mm. And then ideally, you place the hive in a location that has lots of flowers, because that's where the nectar comes from. Mm-hmm. And you really don't have to do very much to get the bees to make honey.
So is this like, you know, could you put them next to an orange tree, a lemon tree, or does it need to be
like
a clover?
But the single tree won't make any difference. I mean, the bees can fly 2 to 3 miles. It takes a lot of trees, a lot of flowers to make enough honey to sustain a hive. And the thing is, the reason we keep bees to produce honey, the reason we can do that is because the bees naturally hoard honey. They want to save enough honey to last them through the winter. So we just take advantage of that. The more space you give them, the more they fill up with honey. So you take some of it away from them. As long as you leave them enough to last through the winter, they don't suffer.
So you don't need a lot of, pollination possibility on the property. They go two to three miles?
They can go 2 to 3 miles. So it's not like you have a cow, right? It's like, the fence doesn't make any difference. People keep bees in New York City. People keep bees on balconies.
Wow. Okay. Okay. So now we'll continue with the process. How does it work?
So basically what you need to do, you need to have a large enough population of bees to bring enough nectar to make honey, because they consume a lot of honey themselves. They consume a lot of pollen. They consume many pounds of pollen a year. The pollen goes to make food that they feed to their young primarily, and the honey is a source of energy. And so at some point, the population of hive gets significant enough that they start bringing surplus honey, and they're saving it and they're storing it away. When the honey comes in, when the nectar comes in, it has about 40 to 50% moisture content, and so the bees move the air through the hive, and as a result, the moisture from the nectar evaporates, and eventually it reaches about 18 to 20%. At which point, the bees declare it to be ready. Hmm. They cover it with a layer of wax, and they save it for the winter.
Wow!
So then you harvest it, you take it off the hive, and you remove the cappings. And there are different ways of doing that. And then you put the frames into an extractor, which is a centrifuge, which spins out the honey, and the honey pours down the walls of the extractor into the bucket, and then you have honey.
So they signal that they're done with making the honey by putting beeswax on top?
It's not that they signal. It's they determine it to be ready.
Right, but that's how they show it.
Well, that's how they show it to me.
Yeah.
The reason they do it for themselves, they're trying to preserve the honey. Because honey absorbs moisture from the environment. They don't want anything to get into the honey, so they seal it. But to me, it says once they sealed it, it's ready.
So it's true sealing wax.
It's beeswax.
Amazing.
Yes.
Okay, and so what, we always hear about the queen bee. What's the role in the queen bee in all this?
Queen bee, her role in life is to lay eggs. Huh. I mean, when the queen slows down, the hive replaces her. They get her to lay eggs in a cell, in a queen cup. It's a specialized cell in which they raise queens. And when the queen is, she lays an egg, they feed that larva as much as they possibly can. They give it tons and tons of food. The better it's fed, the healthier it's going to be. And when the queen and the new queen emerges, frequently the old queen gets bold. They surround her with lots of bees. They heat her up. They kill her. She's not needed. In some number of cases, the mother and daughter queen can coexist. But the queen, her job is basically, she's just an egg-laying machine. That's all she is.
When you're first setting up a hive, how do you know this is going to be a queen who's going to come into the hive to make eggs? Or is that necessary?
The queen does not come into a hive. The queen, if you're just getting bees, the queen has to come with a hive. You can get bees without a queen. Then you have to buy a queen. The queen cannot make the bees cannot make a queen out of nothing.
Ah.
So you need to have larvae that's at most 3 days old.
I see.
So that's how they supersede, right? So that's if you have if a hive loses a queen, they can raise a new queen as long as they have fresh eggs, young eggs.
So if you're wanting to buy a queen, is a queen a queen, or is there a hierarchy of queens?
There are different breeds. There are some queens that allegedly have – it has to do with genetics, right? There are some queens that have varroa-sensitive hygiene. So the varroa is this parasite of bees which decimates hives every winter for us.
Mm.
And so some bees have this ability to detect that the varroa is attacking the brood and actually dig up the brood and get rid of it in the process, just removing, denying the varroa mite opportunity to reproduce. There are some actually. That's one of the things that gets really fascinating, right? So there are some bees that if a larva is being parasitized by a varroa mite, the larva produces pheromone which tells the bees that is being parasitized.
Wow.
They'll open up the cell and remove the larva.
Wow.
So it's really cool. I mean, the things they do is really amazing.
Now, where do Africanized bees come into this equation?
They were brought into South America. They were trying to improve the genetics of European honeybee. They were hoping that by interbreeding the Africanized honeybee with the European honeybee, they'll get a better bee. Africanized bees, several managed to escape. Mm. And they're very robust. They swarm easily, so they move really far. I mean, European honeybees swarm maybe once or twice a year. Africanized honeybees can swarm 5-6 times a year. They make new swarms. They move on. They move on. The only thing that stands in their way right now is the temperature. So if it gets cold enough in the winter, they cannot survive it. But as the climate is warming up, the line past which they can travel is moving further and further north.
So there are bigger problems, say, in Southern California.
Absolutely.
Than here.
I mean, I think recently there was a case where a woman got several hundred stings because she somehow disturbed a hive of Africanized honeybees.
Now, I said in the introduction that we're going to talk about various ways to make money as a beekeeper, and one of them obviously is selling honey. But I would imagine that, bees that swarm in a backyard and the beeswax, you were talking about bees candles. What are the different ways that you can make money and then, as a beekeeper?
Well, there are several ways. Making honey actually is probably not the most profitable part of it.
Hmm.
Beekeepers make money by renting their bees to growers. For instance, you can rent a hive of honeybees to almond grower for about $200 for 2 weeks.
Hmm.
And I know a guy in Grass Valley who has 1,000 hives, so that you can do the math, $200 times 1,000 hives, $200,000. You can make a pretty decent living doing that. A lot of beekeepers sell bees because every winter we lose 25, 30, sometimes more percent of our beehives. And in the spring, if you want to replenish your apiary, you look to buy bees. So people make money doing that. People also sell propolis. propolis is sort of this glue that the bees collect sap from conifers and mix it with some beeswax. It acts as a glue. It actually has antibacterial qualities. So they use propolis to coat the inside of the hive, so it makes it harder for bacteria to take hold inside the hive, and they also use it to glue everything together. If you get a hive that's very heavy on propolizing things, opening up a hive becomes a task, especially when it's cold. Because when it's cold, it's really, really hard.
As an ignorant person about anything to do with beekeeping, I would have thought that in addition to honey, the number one additional source of money would be selling beeswax candles. Is that wrong?
I do sell some. It's a lot of work.
Oh, really? Tell me. Why is it a lot of work?
It's just a little tedious. You know, you heat up the wax, you pour it in the mold, you put a wick in the mold, you heat up the wax, you pour it in the mold, you let it sit for a while, you take it out. You hope that, you know, when you take it out, you don't get any imperfections on the candle. If there are imperfections, you throw them back in a pot and melt them again. I'd rather work with the bees than make candles, honestly.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I am talking with Andriy Kruglikov. He is the owner of Twin Bees Apiaries. Of course, apiaries are places that have beehives in them, in Alameda. But we'll get to that in a minute. Anyway, I think what I want to do is I'm going to ask you now about, you know, what made you, when was the moment you decided you were going to try to make a few bucks as a beekeeper. But I think I'd like to invite listeners, if they are so inclined, if you have a question about what it's really like to be a beekeeper, this is a good time to call. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Was there a specific moment when you decided you were going to try to make money as a beekeeper?
Well, I mean, the first reason I got the bees was for pollination, right? We had those fruit trees, we wanted them pollinated, and it worked really well. Our fruit trees are loaded with fruit. Mm-hmm. But at some point, I had some surplus honey, and there was just no way I could possibly consume it. Mm-hmm. And I contacted people I knew, and some of them showed interest in buying it. And I said, well, why not? I mean, initial investment in beekeeping, you spend hundreds of dollars on equipment, and it's like, well, you know, might as well make a little money out of it. Mm-hmm. And actually, the bigger investment than money is the time. I mean, the time it takes to work with bees can be quite substantial. Mm-hmm. And so since I apparently had opportunity to profit from doing it a little bit, I said, why not?
And, you know, I frankly, in preparing for the show, and we're going to do this in a few minutes, I went to Trader Joe's, my favorite shopping place, and there's like dozens of, or not, no, there's like five or six different kinds of honey, and they sell it for like, you know, I bought this for $3.49. I'm holding up a little bear, you know those bears, we've all seen the bears, but this is Trader Joe's multifloral and clover honey, made in product of the USA. Isn't it hard to distinguish yourself in the marketplace? You can't sell it for $3.49. I can't imagine.
It would not be really worth my while.
Right.
The reason people are willing to spend more money for it is, one is because it's local. Two, because they really like the flavor. I mean, I maintain, and I hope I can demonstrate it, that you can really tell the difference between the honey you buy from the store and the honey you buy from me.
Yeah, we're both going to do that. We're both going to blind taste and see if, you know, if we can tell the differences and which we'd prefer. Anyway, and let's do that. So what I'm going to do is obviously it's radio, so you can't tell, but I like to keep things always as legitimate as I can. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you to turn away.
Okay.
And I'm going to take it. I brought teaspoons here. I'm well prepared, and I'm going to put a little bit on one spoon. And you're going to tell me, you're going to give me your tasting notes, you know, like in wine. You're going to give me your tasting notes and then tell me which one you think is. Okay, now you can turn around.
Okay.
Okay, I've just handed it to him. He has put it in his mouth just the way anybody would. There's no swirling like in fancy frou-frou wine. Okay, your tasting notes, sir.
It's, I think what I taste the most is just the sweetness of it. Mm-hmm. I don't really... I can't really. Oh yeah, what I taste most is sweetness. I can't tell exactly where it came from. People sometimes ask me, so where which plants did the bees visit?
It could be your own honey. I mean, does this taste like your honey? Is it better or worse?
I think not. I think my honey probably tastes better, but I hope I'm right.
Okay. Now, okay. So should I switch? I have extra spoons. We'll give you a fresh spoon here.
Okay.
All right, now you turn away.
All right.
I'm going to do the other one. And I am preparing it as we speak. And then I will have you turn around when I... Not yet.
All right, I'll wait.
Not yet. I've got to close the container so that... 1 second. Okay, now.
Okay. That's mine.
You are 100% correct. Why? How could you tell?
Well, as I harvest honey, I taste it a lot, so I'm familiar with it to the flavor. But if you try it yourself, you will.
I will after, but I will
tell the difference. The flavor of this of my honey is much more complex.
Oh,
it's not just sweet.
Okay,
and I like it better.
Great. After I want to, you know, I always like to prioritize my listeners, so we're going to take a call. And then we're going to reverse roles, and we've got the spoons, and you're going to have me with my terrible taste buds. I would much rather vote for yours. You know, even though I love Trader Joe's, I would certainly rather vote for yours.
You'll have a chance.
Yeah, well, it's 50-50. I couldn't guess right no matter what. Anyway, I'll give out the phone number again. We're going to go to the phones in a second, but I want to give people a chance. If you have a question about what it's really like to be a beekeeper and as a business, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and my guest Andre Kuglikoff is who owns Twin Bee Apiaries in Alameda, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. To the phones, and it's your turn on the air. What's your question or comment for him?
Hi.
Hello.
I was wondering if someone like myself who lives in an apartment or a small house doesn't know much about beekeeping, how...
Okay, I think we got disconnected, but we got the point. She lives in a very small space. Is it realistic to do some beekeeping, at least not get rich, but do some beekeeping and sell honey from an apartment?
People in New York City keep bees on balconies. So it is perfectly feasible. You have to make sure that your neighbors are okay with it, your landlord is okay with it, and you just have a place to put it. I mean, the beehive doesn't take that much space. You don't want the beehive to be some place where you walk all the time. You don't want to run in front of bees because on a hot sunny days you're going to have a lot of bees flying in and out of it, and you can have a misunderstanding. But otherwise, there's no reason not to be able to do it in the apartment.
And if you aren't running in front of them, how likely are you to get stung?
They will not sting you because you're running in front of them. They will generally only attack you if they feel threatened. You know, if you bump into their hive, they get very interested in what you're up to. If you try to squish them, they get very upset.
Dear caller, do you have a follow-up question for him?
No, I don't. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks so much. All the lines are lighted up. Let's go right back to the phones. This is it. We've hit it on a sweet chord, a honey of a show topic. Oh, my. That's bad, bad, bad. Anyway, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. What is your question or comment for Andre of Twin Bee Apiaries? Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. So I just wanted to say an appreciation for raising honey. When I travel throughout California, it's one of my favorite things to buy local honey and try out the different honey in different places, and it all tastes so different. And I wondered if you were going to have a beehive. I live right in the city at Church and Market. If you were going to have a beehive and you wanted to really just produce, you know, enough honey for yourself and pollinate around the area, how many bees would you need? How many hives? And, you know, what would you suggest?
Well, the bees will, you know, if you have a queen and a small group of bees, they'll take care of themselves. They'll build, if you give them space and they have a source of nectar and pollen, they will build up. A hive, I mean, I had a very productive hive that produced over 200 pounds of honey in a year. So you can have more honey you can possibly know what to do with.
One hive?
Yeah, that was for me, that was an outlier.
What's the average? What's the typical?
I get 60, 70 pounds.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of honey. So one hive is plenty. They generally recommend having more than one hive, at least two. And the reason they do that is because if one hive is not doing well, if you have nothing compared to, you don't know it's not doing well. The other reason is if one hive loses a queen, you can borrow a brood from another hive and give it to the hive that lost the queen. They'll raise a new one. It helps to have a backup.
I would think, though, you know, if you only, you know, if you can produce 60 pounds with one hive, so it's unproductive, so it produces a mere 10 pounds of honey. I mean, I don't think I'd need a backup.
Yeah, but you want to make sure they produce enough to survive the winter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the other, just a follow-up question. So I live, you know, right in the city. You know, bees in San Francisco, probably, if I were to do this, would be either in my backyard or maybe on my roof if my landlord didn't notice. You know, they're okay with the cold and all of that.
Oh, they're okay with the cold. They people keep them in Alaska. I mean, they can, as long as the temperature doesn't drop to below 40 degrees below, they'll survive. They shiver to heat up the to keep the queen warm and to keep the brood warm. So they I mean in the places like North Dakota, right? They could be raising brood in the middle of the winter.
Wow. Anyway, great questions, and thank you so much for the call. I hope you do start one. It sounds like fun.
Thank you.
Okay, let's keep taking the calls. Let's go. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's your question for Andrei Kruglikov, who runs Twin Bees Apiaries, about what it's like to be a beekeeper?
Go ahead, please.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hello.
Am I on the air?
You are.
Oh, hi. I'm Kim and Marty. Thank you so much for the show. And
pleasure.
I'm sorry I just lost the person's name, but thank you so much for making honey in Alameda. I hope somehow you can find a way to make more money. And part of the thinking I had is, have you ever thought about signing up with one of the community sourced agricultures or one of the local farms that do the drop-offs, where I go through a pound of honey a month?
Wow.
Easy. And it's the best thing to make lemonade. And I heard recently, and I don't want to start a rumor I didn't know the facts about, but that for people with allergies, if they can eat honey that was local, like within the, like, you know, 20 miles, it helps them deal with the allergies that they have.
I hear it from some of the people.
Because of the propolis, right? And that gets into, I'm talking out of my neck. But that's another thing that a lot of people say, to take fresh is bee pollen and stuff like that, but that sounds a little too fresh, maybe. Doesn't it need to cure in a way? And my last question, that's a little bit more tactful.
Let's take it, you know, let's take it one step at a time. The thoughts about either you making your, selling your stuff through a community group, or, and also the anti allergy properties of bee pollen or whatever.
So to sell it through one of those groups, I don't think I'm big enough. Some people also ask me, why don't you sell at a farmer's market? Farmer's market wants you to be there every weekend. I'm not big enough. I'll run out of honey in the first several weeks, and after that, I have nothing to sell. As far as help with allergies, I have a number of people who buy honey specifically because they claim it helps them with allergies. I also had some people who said it didn't. Mm-hmm. So it really varies.
Perfect. You said you had one more technical question. Go for it.
The idea of the amount of time it takes for a hive, and I've got a bonus one about animals near hives.
The amount of time it takes to
really tend the hive. So they,
oh, I mean, if one, you know, produces, I think a couple of hours. They recommend
a day or a week.
No. The recommendation is to examine your hive every 7 to 10 days.
Oh,
I don't have time for this. I do it less frequently.
Wow!
But it takes.
And they still make 60 pounds.
Well, you know, they may or may not. I mean, they may die. They may
right.
You may lose your bees. It happens too.
How often? What percentage of the hives do the hive die and get no honey?
I think I get about, I lose about 25 to 30% of hives every winter.
Okay.
Because it's dropping, the temperatures are dropping.
And no, it's not. No. The temperatures in California is not an issue. What really is a problem is there's a number of opinions, right? So there's something in the environment. The chemicals in the environment definitely don't help, even if they don't.
Nicotinoids, yes.
Neonics is one, but there are others too. Mm. Even if they don't kill your bees, they weaken them. They make them not live quite as long. They fly from a hive to collect nectar, and they can't find their way back. They can't follow instructions of a scout to find the source of nectar. So it weakens the hive. And the other
so interesting to hear how they actually connect, like, to go out to get it and to get back into it. And so the bonus question is, how friendly is a hive with a dog?
Good question.
Should they not be near each other, or should there be like a 20-foot radius? Or
you know, I think the dogs learn pretty quickly.
One sting learning,
and they kind of stay away. I parked some of my hives in other people's yards, and some of them have dogs, and I haven't heard any major complaints. I mean, they, you know, sometimes it's possible for a dog to get stung, but if they get stung once, they probably will avoid the bees. The bees will not attack an animal unless they feel threatened. And the way they know that they're being threatened is if an animal starts bumping into their hive or tries to eat a bee, they'll trigger an attack. But otherwise, the bees are primarily interested in flowers.
Well, thank you very much. Those questions were not
too
technical. They were interesting. Thanks a lot for calling the show. Enough call. Let me just ask you a few more questions before I let you go. What might surprise, we're going back to the career or the money made, the business of being a beekeeper. What's something that might surprise me about being a beekeeper?
I think that two things, well, maybe three things. The amount of time it takes. I mean, if you think about it, two hours per hive is a lot of time. And as you get more hives, you start cutting corners.
How many hives do you have?
20.
So there's 40 hours every how long?
Every week, every 3 weeks even.
The thing
is I have a full-time job, which means that I only have a weekend. Mm-hmm. So that limits it.
Got it.
The amount of how physical it is. Lifting a box of honey can weigh anywhere between, 40 and 80 pounds. So it's heavy. And the other thing is how amazingly hot it is inside a bee suit. Even on a not very warm day, I'm drenched.
You're wearing Tyvek, which doesn't. Is that
no, it's
right?
Not Tyvek. It's actually a bee suit that's supposed to breathe.
Oh.
And even so, I get drenched. By the end of the day, I'm just like you can wring me out.
Now, as I understand, you told me that before the show. You said that one of the ways that a beekeeper can make some money is cleaning out swarms, because apparently a swarm can form in somebody's on their patio or whatever.
Right?
Tell us about that.
So, I belong to a group, Alameda County Beekeeper Association, and we collect swarms for free. But there are people who out there who collect a swarm. Collecting a swarm is really fairly easy. The swarms are generally not aggressive. They're just sitting around waiting to move into the permanent hive. And collecting them, it could be as easy as just shaking the bees into a box. If you got the queen and the queen doesn't mind your box too much, you got a colony of your own.
Okay. Well, I think what I want to do now is remember we said before the break.
So now it's my turn.
Now it's your turn. So dear listeners who are just joining us, you see, I am talking with Andrei Kruglikoff, who owns Twin Bee Apiaries, and I thought it would be fun to do a blind taste test. And so I went to my favorite store, Trader Joe's, and I bought their basic honey, and shaped in the plastic bear, multifloral and clover honey. And then I asked Andre to bring his basic honey. And I did a blind taste, and I had him turn away and see if he could tell his honey from the cheap honey. And he told in 1 second, instantly, he said it was much more complex, much more interesting. But let's see whether me, with my terrible non-gourmet taste buds, will be able to. So I am now handing him both the Trader Joe's honey as well as his own. And I'm going to turn away now. And he's going to prepare two different spoons full and then give me one and then give me the other and see if I'll give you my tasting notes.
All right, just 1 second.
Forgive the silence here. I'm turning away, so I can't really talk into the microphone because I don't want to look. And you just tell me, Andre, when to turn around. So
just one moment.
I'll take yes, no problem. Then I'm going to ask, of course, as the last question, I'm going to ask him the softball question of how can we buy your honey? But still, what are you doing? Making the honey, or are you putting together a
swarm? I'm talking to the bees.
A swarm? You're
okay,
talking?
There you go.
Okay, all right. Give me one.
Okay. Number one.
Okay.
I just dropped some honey on your desk. I hope you don't mind.
No. Number one. It tastes delicious to me. It tastes very good. Sweet, of course. But
honey is the sweetest substance known to man. It's much sweeter than sugar.
I didn't know. Right. Oh, well, I find this very tasty. Okay.
Okay. Here you go.
Okay, I'm going to cleanse my palate, and I'm going to try this one. I don't know. Subjectively, I like it a little less well.
Really?
Oh, no.
That's okay.
I guess. I changed my mind. No, it was the second one. I love
it. That's not fair.
I couldn't tell. I kind of love them both. I don't know. The second one was
mine.
Okay. You don't trust me. You can trust me about career issues, but you cannot trust me about food. I am not a gourmet. I'm a kid who would like junior high school cafeteria food. But all right, but I digress. Okay, most people find your honey superior, and I swear, the reason I chose this guy, I looked up people who were beekeepers, and I looked for the ones that had a lot of Yelp reviews that were five-star. This guy's off the charts, absolutely off the charts. So if you would like to buy local, organic, sustainable, they're right, it's all local, organic, sustainable.
I can't say it's organic because I cannot guarantee that the plants from which the bees collect the nectar,
right, because you're not following the bees, but they're certainly local.
And I don't use any nasty chemicals in the hive, and I don't add anything to it, and I don't heat it. I don't mess with it in any way.
Great. So if they want to buy your honey, how can they do so?
You can send me email at twinbeeperies@gmail.com.
And that's spelling for those who are not great spellers. It's twin, B-E-E, of course, like a bee. And then apiaries is A-P-I-A-R-I-E-S.
At gmail.com. You can also look up Twin Bee Apiaries Alameda on Yelp.
Or Google.
And right, and there is my contact information there, too.
Well, I told you you would do great, and it was fun. Was it not fun?
That was interesting.
Anyway,
thank you.
Thank you very much, Andre, for being my guest at Work with Marty Nemko.
Okay, anyway, thank you. It was really nice being here.
Wonderful. Okay, and so now, my dear listeners, we turn to you. One of the core functions, probably the core function of this show, is to help you with your individual work problem. It's fun to hear about little careers that we may not have heard of before or heard of but don't really know what it's really like on the inside. But it's more practical, if you will, and you know, to help you with your work problem. Whether you are unemployed or you are well-employed and still unhappy, whether you are self-employed, whether you are working for the government, for a nonprofit, or a for-profit, whether you're 16 or 76, this is my pro bono work, I love to help you solve your work-life problems. And the price is certainly right, zero. And this is the time to call. I always feel bad at the end of the show when all the lines are lighted up and I can't get to the callers. So if you have a work-related problem, or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, or you want me to play Shark Tank with you, you've got a small business or a small business idea that you want me to ask you questions about, call in for what I call a workover with no pummeling involved, usually. The phone number here at KLW and Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. One of the things I like to do in between calls or waiting for the calls, they're coming in, but I like to talk about under-the-radar careers because the competition for the well-known careers is so fierce that it's helpful often to share ideas that you wouldn't have thought of. It seems like half the people here in the Bay Area want to be engineers of some sort. But even in that in-demand market, whether you're a software engineer or a civil engineer or an electrical engineer, the competition can be enormous. But there is an under-the-radar niche in engineering that is wonderful called fire protection engineering. As we know, fire is a danger that can impact an entire community. Each year in the U.S., more than 3,000 people die, thousands are injured, and billions of dollars are lost as a result of fire. To combat those losses, fire protection engineers using really cool ideas and technologies to make our world safer. They will protect the environment, of course, because you're not having all that fire come up into the air. They protect property and, most important, people. So I just wanted to share that with you as a career. And the market is great. Students who just have a bachelor's, you don't need a master or PhD, a bachelor's in fire protection engineering is great. Most of the graduates of programs have multiple offers by the time they graduate college, which is awesome. And the pay is solid six figures. I've heard of fire protection engineers working on really interesting projects, everything from prevention, like designing a Las Vegas casino to be safe from fire, to protecting a nuclear power plant, to designing a fire protection system for a well-known museum. So very interesting career, under the radar. To find out more about it, you want to go and get Google this. It's available online, I believe. It's the SFPE, I guess Society for Fire Protection Engineering, Guide to Careers in Fire Protection Engineering, or simply just Google Society for Fire Protection Engineers. That's SFPE.org, and I'm sure you could learn about this quite interesting under-the-radar career. And now, let's just go right to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi, am I on the air, Marty?
You are.
That's amazing. This is actually the first time I've ever called into a radio show.
Wow. Well, I hope to make it a nice experience and maybe even a profitable one for you.
Yes, let's hope so. So it's funny that you opened up talking about engineers. I'm 38 years old, and I've been involved in engineering and design since I guess I was 22 or 24, somewhere in there.
Okay.
But I've been making websites since I was like in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And around 2012, I was working for kind of like a creative agency. Mm-hmm. We were doing some promotional work for a very large company. And the work itself was super interesting to me. But I got so burnt out by the project, I realized I felt completely unmotivated by the purpose of the work that we were doing. And I decided to strike out on my own and kind of be a contractor and try to pursue jobs that I thought actually would make some kind of positive impact in the world.
Do you want to tell me what you were doing? You want to tell me what the project you were working on that kind of burned you out for lack of interest?
It was basically, I mean, well, let's put it this way. It was, let me tell you, it was super interesting, and I loved a lot of the people that I was working with. But it was a big museum exhibition with tons of computers in a foreign country. And it was like a multi-million dollar project, and it won tons of awards and things like that. So, yeah, you know, it was a pretty impressive project. You'd give presentations on it, and people would, like, want to hire you and be excited about it.
Why did it feel empty?
Well, it felt empty because it was a promotional kind of, it was like a promotional exhibition for a web browser. And, you know, it didn't really feel to me personally like it aligned with what I want to see more of in the world. And I felt weird working on a project. I'm not saying that we don't need better web browsers or things like that. I just don't really feel like in a world with so many engineers doing so much bright work out there that I should be spending my time trying to support industries that are already doing just fine without me.
Okay.
When I'm so much more interested in helping people do things that are more necessary, like, you know, cleaning up the environment or improving people's mental health or things like that.
Great. Okay, good. So now I understand the rationale. Continue. So you're telling me you left to try to find something that was more meaningful to you, and...
And so I started focusing, I do electrical engineering and software design, but I started focusing on web stuff because the thing is that everybody needs a website.
Absolutely.
And I think I was restricting the kind of work that I wanted to do as far as the impact that it makes. I ought to probably choose a field that was in high demand.
Mm-hmm.
So I started focusing on making web apps. I learned a bunch of, you know, frameworks like... stuff that, you know, a lot of your listeners, maybe some of them know them, you know, like Angular and React and all this stuff, focusing on front end. And, you know, to some degree, it's been great. I've had clients who are amazing. I worked on a project that was sponsored by the Dalai Lama about emotional awareness. I've worked on a dashboard for a wave sensor that can potentially help make shipping routes way more efficient and save fuel. So this is cool stuff,
right?
But I'm 38. I just got married. At this point, I've got a mortgage, and it's like the life of a contractor is killing me.
Yep.
It's insane. I'm so blessed to have the skills that I have, but the amount of anxiety I experience, given the skills that I have, it's ridiculous. And I don't think it's really. It doesn't make sense for me to be living my life this way.
Right.
Yet. I haven't found a company or something that provides me the lifestyle that I want and that's doing the things that I want to be supporting. And so it's kind of a weird bind. It's not a bind. I'm just basically trying to do better for myself in terms of the kind of work that I do and not so much like find a way to make better money doing
what
I do.
You know, first a side note, you know, it is said the gig economy has very few winners other than the employer and a lot of losers, because it is stressful to know that there is this axe hanging over your head every time you go to work. Is there going to be somebody cheaper locally or somewhere in the world who could do your work for less, or could it be automated? And then you're spending time looking for your next gig. It's really very worker unfriendly. I'm very concerned about the ever increased gigification of America. And by the way, on August 23rd, my guest has just written a book called Gigged, about the people who have been gigged to misery. So my question to you is this: given that, you know, the snippets that you sounded most excited about was the environment. You both said you were excited about working on that shipping project, which enabled more efficient shipping routes and therefore saved environmental money. And you also, the first thing you talked about being meaningful was environment. Are there not in-house environmental jobs? Small companies can't afford in-house people. But are there large environmental entities that would welcome a guy with your chops?
You know, it's possible. I think I could look in that direction to make things even more difficult for you.
That's all right. I love the challenge. It's great. We'll come up with the best possible solution. I promise you. At least I'll make my best effort. Go ahead.
So basically, as you know, SF is like impossible to buy a house in.
Yeah, right? It's unbelievable. It's crazy. The prices are absurd.
So, you know, that's not where my wife and I got our house.
Right.
We're both freelancers. So we got a country house, and we have a rent-controlled apartment in the city,
uh-huh.
And we have a mortgage that's like less than half of the mortgage that
right.
we would have to pay in the city.
Right.
And that way we get to have a house, but we're not, you know, spending like $800,000 or $1 million
right.
on a fixer-upper in some horrible neighborhood.
Of course you're right.
So what it means is that my current work situation is great because I can work from home.
Right. Remote work is the obvious answer, yeah.
It's key for me to maintain the lifestyle that I've committed to. So basically, and I just want to emphasize here, I'm not trying to say that I've got it bad or something. I called because it's a problem I've been grappling with, and it seems like you're an expert. And I thought it might be interesting also for other people who are in my similar situation to hear about ideas, how to take their career in a direction that might be more fulfilling or motivating in the ways I've described. I don't mean to say that I'm, you know, unlucky somehow because I...
Right, I got it. And I think everybody else gets it too. But what seems to me clear is the real message to you, you know, I'm glad that you're interested not only in my helping you with your problem, but that has implications for everybody. You know, in life, it really is critical to ask for what you want. You've got the skills. So by making non-negotiable that you work remotely or perhaps come in only for part of the week, you can have everything you want. You can have the house without the absurd mortgage cost, and you can be working at home where you're more likely to work anyway. I mean, there's been recent studies that show that today's workplace, which is the open workplace where everybody is in one large room, nobody can concentrate. I mean, that was common sense 20 years ago, but now there's good data to support it. So why not be really focused, which is to make a list of the 10 nonprofit or for-profit, doesn't matter, environmental entities, for or nonprofit, from the Nature Conservancy to some pollution control companies or whatever, that are large enough that they would have in-house programmers, web people, web design people, electrical engineers, and reach out to their CTO, their chief technology officer, or some director or VP level person, and say, here are my chops. This is what I can do. But what's non-negotiable for me is that I work remotely for at least part of the week. If I said that that's the kind of, you know, not just answer ads, which it's fine. You've got good skills. Certainly apply for those jobs. And then in the interview process, certainly say, hey, non-negotiable for me is that I work remotely for at least part of the week. So both when you're interviewing for a job, make that non-negotiable. And in addition, reach out to the CTO or vice president of technology or whatever and say, this is my dream. Is it realistic? And you never know, you could at least be the inside candidate for a job when it becomes posted. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I like that idea of reaching out to CTOs for sure.
There you go. Well, I thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you so much, Marty. Bye-bye.
Great. Bye. Wonderfully articulate. You know that stereotype of engineers not being able to be articulate? That guy was terrific. Anyway, I'll go back to the phones right away. I'll give out the phone number again, though. If you've got a work-related problem of any sort, you don't have to be a techie. You could be a total non-techie. Whatever your work problem or self-employment situation, or even have a story. I love stories. I think everybody loves stories. If you've got a work story, something interesting that happened to you this week, you want to share it? I'm happy to share the airtime with you. Phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Back to the phones. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello. It is you.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks, Marty, for taking my call. I had a question regarding a international transfer. So I'm currently working for a company down in the South Bay that has an opportunity in Dublin. And it seems super exciting, and it seems like I'd be able to get a lot of great experience under my belt. The only caveat is I would be taking a pay cut if I make the transfer. So I wanted to see where your advice would land there.
Well, my general advice is, unless it's a massive pay cut, which you then have a hard time kind of climbing back up from, let's say you were making $150,000. No, let's pick a, tell me the numbers. What are you currently making? What would the job pay?
Currently, I'm at like $110,000 now annually, and the job would be paying in euros.
Yeah.
And that would be around $75,000 to $77,000.
Okay. So. It depends how important them, because you'll lose half of it in taxes anyway. But I have it in general. I err on the side of taking it. I'm very non-materialistic, but that's just me. And the fact that you said you really love it, and you'd learn a lot. And in the arc of your career, in the arc of your life, you're probably not going to do it forever. But if you did that for 1, 2, 3 years, whatever it is, and gleaned all of that in the arc of your life, I think you will have felt good about having done that. And even if you then, let's say you're making 77, and you're having to tighten your belt a lot, and now you're back in the United States, you've learned as much as you can or you want to in Dublin, and now you're going for your next job, and they're going to, on the application form, they're going to say, well, what was your most recent salary? And you're going to say 77. So there's no reason why, A, you couldn't even on the application form put an asterisk and explain that it was a job in Europe where cost of living is a lot lower, and B, that you did take it specifically because you wanted to enrich your skill set and experiences, which will make you a better employee. So you may even be able to talk your way back in to a higher salary once you get back. But I'm not of the sort who turns down an opportunity that feels really good to you for an extra after taxes $25,000 or $20,000. That's one guy's subjective opinion. What's your reaction?
I resonate with it. Yeah, I agree. I don't think it'll be a huge change, and the cost of living is not.
You've cut out there.
But I was saying I don't think it's going to be a huge change, but I appreciate the reaffirmation. I think I am going to take the opportunity.
And what I would do also is, you know, housing is your biggest cost. And usually the cost in the desirable areas in the city of Dublin, I know nothing about Dublin real estate, but are quite high. But if you were to live 10 miles away or 15 miles away, the cost difference may be enormous. And so your after-tax difference in terms of disposable income may not be that great. So it's yet one more, you know, so you can get to do the Dublin thing without paying too heavy a price in terms of your lifestyle. What do you think?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay, I thank you. Another interesting call. I've never gotten a call about that. I'd say that's fresh. After 28 and a half years, I still got a fresh call. That's great. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello? Are you there? Are you there? Let's go to the next line. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi. Hi. So I'm in a situation where I'm 28. I went to undergrad and got a degree in environmental science, and I had a difficult time breaking into the field. And so I found a work in a slightly different field, and I'm again trying to break in, and I'm finding some difficulty. It doesn't pay that well, so I'm considering either going back to school to continue something environmental. I'm thinking maybe, I don't know, some kind of coding boot camp, which I know it's somewhat interesting to me, and I know that the pay is good. The pay that I'm getting paid right now is not great for the area.
I need to back you up a little bit. Tell me a little bit about what was the job you were hoping to get when you first finished your bachelor's degree?
I was hoping to do something so I did environmental science and geology. So I was hoping to do something in like environmental consulting. So like kind of pre-construction evaluation, like soil, water, air testing.
Yeah. And what ended up actually happening? Why were you unable? Do you think to think you were not able to land a job in that?
So I applied for a number of jobs, and it really seemed that, well, I either wouldn't get responses or talking to other people in the field, that a lot of them require either, like, basically a civil engineer would take my place, a mechanical engineer would take my place, a master's student would take my place, and so it seemed like there was a higher supply and a lower demand.
So what did you end up pivoting to?
So I'm in engineering consulting. I'm not an engineer, so I'm naturally kind of limited in that in that field.
Right.
So I'm considering, I'm at a three-point diversion here, where I could either go back to school for something environmental, I could try to do coding, or I've also always kind of been interested in nursing, which is something that I can see myself doing, like, long term, and I really like, a lot of things resonate with me as far as, like, scheduling. I'm very social, and I think there's a lot of appeal there, but I'm kind of starting from scratch again. Yep.
Here's my first take. I think that probably what happened is this. I think nursing would be, it's a too long, you have a lot of prerequisites, a long time, and then you're making the judgment that you're going to be that much happier in nursing down the road. It's a very, very different skill set. What it seems to me is the way you described your initial search seemed inadequate. You said you applied for a lot of jobs and you got no responses. I mean, that's the usual thing. But I'm wondering if you had done what is the standard good advice, or at least I tell my clients this, which be to get very involved, for example, in your professional association, online forums, in-person meetings, trying to build a network, try to build relationships, maybe getting a special certificate in some niche in geology, you know, some specialization. I'm wondering whether before I made this radical change into nursing, whether you might do a smarter job search, perhaps first gain some competence, take an online course, you know, in Udacity or Udemy or Coursera or LinkedIn Learning or whatever, till you got some fresh expertise that's in an area that you're interested in that's in demand. And with that fresh certification, it could be a short course, then go and try to get involved in the professional association, online forums, as well as apply for jobs, you know, that are advertised. And that might enable you to do what you felt you were meant to do from the beginning. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Thanks very much for calling the show. I'm going to take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi, this is James from San Francisco.
Hi, James.
Hi, I just quit my job recently, and I've been a teacher for about 6 years. Mm-hmm. And I taught social studies, and I taught history, and I have a master's in it as well. But I just felt like I kind of fell into teaching. And so I recently quit, and I didn't burn any bridges. Mm-hmm. But and I've been I just hired like a career coach, but it doesn't really seem to help, and I feel very kind of overwhelmed with a lot of possibilities, because everything sounds really, really great and fun, but I don't want to waste what I've already put in, all this time and energy and money. But I also can see myself getting into something completely different. So I'm in my mid-30s, and I'm trying to weigh things out, and so I feel a little bit overwhelmed.
Great. Let's see if we only have a couple of minutes, but let's see if we can find some measure. Why don't you tell me that you said a lot of things sound good. Tell me two that at least feel in contention, because that gave me some clues about you, and we can work from there.
Right. I feel like public policy. I'm very passionate about, like, you know, public transit and whatnot, and kind of negotiating with people. I was a union representative, and I really liked kind of leading in that aspect. So I'm very passionate about public issues.
Got it. So let's take, I like that because it's specific. Being a union rep is kind of broad, but interested specifically in public transit is really good. Does it matter whether it's bikes or BART or trains or ride sharing? All that stuff's okay. And given that you're interested in policy, if I said I want you to make a list of the agency, for example, there's a Metropolitan Transportation Commission that is a supervisory organization for all the counties and sister, and spend a lot of time on the website because they will know the wide range of enterprises that they're involved in. Uh-huh. What is the role of Caltrans? What is the role of AC Transit? What is the role of BART? What is the role of Ford's share a bike thing? And then you might be able to have a clearer sense of where you might focus your efforts and get involved in meetups or other kind of entities to get immersed in that space, and that might make you an inside candidate for a job. How's that sound?
That sounds great.
Well, at least for 2 minutes, it was, for a price of zero, it wasn't too bad. Anyway, I wish you the best of luck. You are certainly riding the wave, pardon the pun. Maybe that's the answer. Maybe surfboard riding is the answer.
Mm-hmm.
You are certainly riding the wave, notwithstanding Donald Trump. We are moving, especially here in California, in a direction in which that is primary. So I think, I'm optimistic about your prospects.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Take care.
On
the July 5th show, Work with Marty Nemko, I interviewed the retired chief judge of the Ninth Circuit, our circuit, Alex Kaczynski, about what it's like to be a judge. And in the pre-interview, he told me that he was under strict instruction from counsel to not discuss why he retired, and it was allegations of sexual harassment. And I agreed to not mention the allegations during the interview. I made the judgment call that the listeners would nonetheless benefit from having him on the show because his answers in the pre-interview were very good and because KLW listeners would value hearing a long-form interview, had him for an hour, with the chief judge of our circuit. Well, in the interest of transparency with you as listeners, KLW's general manager, Matt Martin, thought it was important you hear from me about why I didn't address those allegations during my interview, and so I wanted to share that with you. In any case, that is a Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. By the way, I also do want to thank Andrei Kugliakov. He was a great guest, and he runs Twin Bees Apiaries, selling great, great honey. Yelp reviews off the charts, even if my taste buds were not discerning enough. Anyway, but I wanted to give him another shout-out because he was terrific. Do please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover. Plus, from the sundial to the hourglass, to the Rolex, to the Timex, to the Atomic Watch, to the Apple Watch, we care about time, perhaps especially so in our ever more time-pressured existence. So I will talk with Paul Sarigan, who's made a living being a true expert on watches. Until then, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't. We'll be right back.